Good morning. It's good to be here. I want to thank the elders for the invite and grateful to all of you as the church here. I'm here to serve you this week. I'm not on vacation, and so use me if I can be of any benefit whatsoever to the work here. I want to be at your disposal. Plugging into our purpose. I've done this lesson literally hundreds of times, and I even do it on the front end of my personal evangelistic studies with people, although I'm going to share with you some background information about Ecclesiastes that is broader than what I do with non-Christians. But so much of the time we get caught up in life and we forget about the big picture. And there's just a lot of bad news in the world right now. And the economy may be showing little signs of improvement, but my wife is from Germany, and so we keep tabs on what's going on in Europe, and it's a mess over there. And that could spread to here, and there's just so much bad news out there. I'm here to present some good news this week, the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's the greatest news that anyone ever had. And I'm currently preaching back where I grew up in Santa Clara, California, the Silicon Valley. And one of the companies out there is this little company called Google. And Apple, Google, Yahoo, Hewlett-Packard, they're all based just down the street from where we live. But Google has 10 core principles as a company. And one of them, principle number two, it's best to do one thing really, really well. Sometimes we get focused on 10 things or 100 things, and we don't do any of them well. But if we could do one thing really, really well, one thing that we ought to do really, really well is to dangle the gospel carrot before as many people as we possibly can. And a number of years ago, I got the distinct impression that our culture was undergoing a radical shift. When I grew up, even out in California, we pretty much could assume 50 years ago a shared heritage of respect for biblical principles. And in some pockets of the country, you still can. But for the most part, that day is gone. And more so, we're running into a culture that knows nothing about the Bible. I know that, especially where I preach out there, people are outright hostile to biblical principles. But some people are searching. They know there's got to be something better than this. And so Ecclesiastes has come in very handy to me to use in evangelistic studies. On the front end, it pulls people in, and part of handling accurately the word of truth is knowing how to use the sword of the Spirit to penetrate those deep recesses of the heart where soul and spirit are divided, joints and marrow meet, and the thoughts and intentions of the heart are discerned. And I believe the Lord has given us a powerful tool in Ecclesiastes. The way I look at the Bible is it's like a giant jigsaw puzzle. You got 66 pieces, and every piece has a purpose. And where Ecclesiastes comes in is it really helps us with the whole issue of why we're here. Why are we here? A lot of people don't really know. Philip Yancey suggested a few years ago that not many sermons get preached on Ecclesiastes, for it is one of the Bible's most confusing books, he said. Many conservative Christians treat it with polite distaste as if it had sneaked into the canon when no one was looking. I have a much higher regard for Ecclesiastes than that, and I'm sure you do as well. But I'll tell you something. I preached in Birmingham in the South. I preached out West. I've done meetings all over this country. And so I've got a pretty good feel for what's out there in this country. And there are just a lot of people who don't even know why they're here. A lot of people. This happened in my neck of the woods in Fremont, California. Some years ago, a 17-year-old girl named Karen Ching achieved a perfect score on both sections of the SAT test and a perfect 8,000 on the Tufts University of California Acceptance Index. No one in history had gotten a perfect score on both of those tests in the same year. Brilliant young lady, straight-A student. And so the world has been blessed with this brilliant, one-of-a-kind young woman who is probably on her way to a successful law career by now if she continued her planned studies. But the national survey included, or the national story included, a brief but significant exchange with a reporter who asked Karen, what is the meaning of life? And her answer was, I have no idea. I would like to know myself. There are a lot of people in our country, a lot of people in this world, who don't know anything more than young Karen did about the purpose of life. And so Ecclesiastes comes in handy because it forces that issue. It forces people to think about that. And I find it universally appealing. I've studied this with atheists. I've studied it with agnostics. I've studied it with professed believers in Christ to help them come closer to looking at what the Bible really says about salvation issues and so forth. And I've hardly ever come through this one-shot study I do with people without people becoming very interested in what comes next. And so when I end a study with non-Christians based on what I'm about to tell you, almost everybody wants to come back for more. And so if that doesn't get your attention, I don't know what will. Use this if you can to touch others' lives, but also use it to think about yourself. Now, I'm going to tell you some things on the front end here that are just between you and me. I don't deal with all this information with non-Christians. And first of all, how is the book's message communicated? I'm a real student by nature. I've got a ton of books, and I study them. And one thing I'm interested in when I study the Bible is not only what is said, but how it is said. And that's just me. You don't necessarily have to be as interested in that topic as I am. But how does Ecclesiastes communicate the message? How should the book be classified? How is the book's truth communicated? Leland Ryken calls Ecclesiastes protest literature. We usually classify it as part of the wisdom and poetry section of the Old Testament. The author calls himself the words of the preacher, or opens the book with that note. And I believe Solomon wrote the book personally, but he calls himself the preacher, the teacher. You could also translate that Mr. Preacher, which implies either a literary device or that he's distancing himself from his role as the king and taking on the mantle of a wise man. Yancey calls him the first existentialist. And certainly Ecclesiastes gives way to the despair of avant-garde philosophy, though at the end, despair gives way to hope. You know, I was doing a study one time and had some former Hindus, some Indians. And this one guy came up to me at the end of the study, said, you know, this is neat stuff. He said it reminded him of the Bhagavad Gita, the so-called holy book of Hinduism. He said, you got all these cycles of life. He said, but there's one difference. In Ecclesiastes, you've got a resolution in the end. But in the Gita, the cycles never end. And I thought that was an outstanding insight on his part. You know, the answer to why we exist in Ecclesiastes is found more through firsthand experience than a burst of special revelation. We're privileged to go on a grand search through the eyes of one who had the wherewithal that eludes most of us. Revelation is there, no doubt. I mean, fear God and keep His commandments. That's right. And I believe the Holy Spirit guided the whole search here. However, you don't have, you know, Ecclesiastes doesn't read like, okay, you know, why are you here? Here's the answer. Boom. It reads like, okay, let's look behind door number one. Oh, that's not it. Well, how about door number two? Well, that's not it either. How about door number three? Well, that's not it either. And so through a process of elimination, he rules out all of the historic pursuits of mankind, pursuits in which people think, well, this has got to be the answer, or that has got to be the answer. And so wisdom comes largely through observation. What I say is Ecclesiastes is the most inductively reasoned book in the Bible, because it's like we're on a grand search and you've got to kind of suspend your judgment till you get to chapter 12 and you get to the very end, and finally you reach the conclusion of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments. But until you get there, you're kind of held in suspension. And it's, you know, suspended animation, where God is permitting him and us as well through him to see from an experiential standpoint that the historic pursuits of mankind are nothing but dead end streets. And in that regard, as one commentator says, Ecclesiastes is a negative preparation for the gospel, because it rules out everything else, all the other things that people look for. And all you're left with at the end is fear God and keep His commandments. This is the only thing left that makes any sense, because all this other stuff doesn't. Interesting book in that regard. The other interesting thing about Ecclesiastes is you have what I like to call oscillations of thought, or a contrasting set of opposites in the book, where the... Well, you basically have an invitation to experience the process. For example, you'll have Solomon saying, you know, life is really, really bad. And then the next paragraph, you'll say, life is really great. And then life is really bad. And then life is great. And either he is schizophrenic, or... he's inviting us to experience the process of discovery with him, and until he gets to chapter 12, he hasn't found the answer yet. And I think that's the key, that when you're jerked around back and forth, it's because you're still in the middle of the search. And as long as you understand that, as you're reading through Ecclesiastes, you'll understand that you've got, as Ryken says, 15 negative sections, 13 positive, and three mixed. Negative sections, life is no good. Positive sections, life is great. It just depends on your perspective. And again, as he's getting to the end of the book, it's like a maze. It's like lots of twists and turns and dead ends until you finally find the conclusion at the end of the matter. The only thing that hasn't evaporated with the wind at the end of the book is fear God and keep His commandments. So that's all preliminary information. I don't deal with all this when I study this with non-Christians. That's just for you and me. But let me dive into what I cover usually. And let me give you this illustration first. Francis Crick, who together with James Watson discovered the structure of DNA in 1953, wrote a book in 1994 toward the very end of his life. And it's called The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. In that book, he argues that you, your joys and your sorrows, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. That's a humble claim for a man to make in a book. And we know intuitively there's got to be more to us than that. We know that deep down. We know intuitively, but Ecclesiastes forces that issue. And again, I love to use this with evangelism. When I go fishing for men, I want the best bait I can find to put on my hook, and it's been a marvelous tool for me the last 20, 25 years of my life. So, what I study with people is chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 12, and I encourage them to read the whole book, but in one setting. On the front end of evangelistic studies with people, I study chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, and then chapter 12. So let's do that. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? I'll stop and make a couple of comments as we go through. The word for vanity can also be translated vapor, vapor of vapors. It's all vapor. And the question posed in verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun, is what do we hope to accomplish by everything that we do in this life? Another way of wording that question is why are we here? What is our purpose in life? Verse 4 says, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Not literally forever, but with regard to a human lifespan, we pass the torch to the next generation and life goes on without us. You know, with or without us, life goes on. This earth continues on and we may or may not be here. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. What you have here are three illustrations of the point that he makes. In verse 4, a generation goes, generation comes, but life goes on. And you have in verse 5, the rising and the setting of the sun. Everything goes in cycles, the rising and the setting of the sun. Verse 6, the blowing of the wind. And verse 7, the evaporation cycle. And what that means basically is that this life is cyclical. Whether you're talking about the earth revolving around the sun, or the four seasons, or the beat of a heart, or the respiration and exhalation, or just about anything else you can name about life as we know it upon the earth, we have cycles, never-ending cycles. And those cycles can be extended to what we do from day to day. You get up in the morning, you take a shower, you eat breakfast, you fight traffic, you go to work, you fight traffic, you go home, you put your head on the pillow at night, and what do you do the day after that? The same thing. And the day after that, and the day after that, and the day after that. And in the midst of that monotony, people ask themselves, is there anything more than this? And so what Solomon is doing here is he's forcing that issue. All things, verse 8, are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. It's like a giant racetrack. You go around in circles, but are you getting anywhere? Or a hamster on that little circular thing in the cage, just go, you know, driving himself silly, but not getting anywhere. And that's where human beings find themselves, going around in never-ending circles. Been there, done that, is like how I like to summarize that whole process. Is there anything new to this? Technology has changed the equation a little bit, but the basic issues of life are the same since Solomon's day. They really haven't changed. Verse 10, is there a thing of which it is said, see this, it is new, it has already been in the ages before us? There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. You know, I'll tell you what, I do to illustrate this to non-Christians. I say, you know, do you know who your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were? And there's a few genealogy buffs that once in a while, you know, oh, yeah, sure, I know. But most of the time, nobody knows. Why is that? Were they not important? Sure they were important. But why don't we know who they were? And the plain truth of the matter is, for those of us who are honest, is we just haven't taken the time to learn who they were because they're not important enough to us in the life that we're living right now because we're caught up in our own lives, not theirs. And we all know that deep down. And if that's the case, there's no remembrance of earlier things, and we don't know who our great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were, what are the chances if life should go on indefinitely that our great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren will give a hoot who we were. And when I ask that question, you know, it's like the jaw drops for non-Christians. You know, Solomon had a point there. We're going around in cycles. We pass the torch to the next generation only to be forgotten by subsequent generations. Is what we're accomplishing right here and right now really that important? Or are we just going through the motion, spinning our wheels? That's a good question. And everybody I study this with can relate to that, whether they know the Bible or not. And so when I've got them in the palm of my hand, I turn immediately to chapter 2, beginning with verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, and I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. Notice how many times he uses a personal or reflexive pronoun of me, myself, and I here. It was all done with a personal, even self-centered frame of reference. I made gardens and parks. I built in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools with which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. In other words, in the midst of all this luxury, I kept my head screwed on straight. Verse 10, and whatsoever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. For my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. In other words, he had anything he wanted. Anything. I want that. It was his. Unbelievable. We don't have that wherewithal, but he did. Here's a man who, according to 1 Kings, you look at the end of 1 Kings 4, you look at 1 Kings 10 and 11, you know, he wrote 1,005 songs, 3,000 proverbs. He had chariots, he had horsemen, he had splendor, he had palaces. He built the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem. The Queen of Sheba comes in chapter 10. She says, the half has not been told. I've seen it with my own eyes. The half has not been told. Chapter 11, he had 700 wives, 300 concubines. You know, you can hardly quantify all the splendor and majesty that Solomon had at his disposal. Was he happy? No, he was miserable. Look at verse 11. Then I considered the toil that I had expended in doing, or all that my hands had done, and the toil that I expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So here's what I do when I study this with non-Christians. We read this, and I make a few points about the background of Solomon's life, and then I just ask them to fill in the blank. You know, how would people fill in the blank? You know, if I only had blank, then I'd be happy. What's the number one answer? Money. Okay. If I only had $1 million, or let's just make it $10 million because of the inflation that we're about to... If I only had $10 million, then I'd be happy. Would you? Was Howard Hughes happy? He would trade it all for one happy marriage. Okay, so let's take all the money and bring in the wife. Are all married? You know, a lot of people, if I only had that perfect spouse, then I'd be happy. Are all married people happy? No. Let's bring in some kids. We need some kids. Got to have some kids. Are all parents happy? No. No. you're a little bit too emphatic on that point. okay. if I only had a bigger house or the bigger vehicle to put all those kids in, then I'd be happy. Are all homeowners happy? Man, this mortgage is killing me, and I'm underwater financially with the mortgage payments, and if I only had that advancement in my career, then I'd be happy so I could pay for that mortgage. Are all people who climb the corporate ladder happy? No. Man, this work is killing me. Oh, if I could only be retired. Are all retired people happy? Man, my body's falling apart. Oh, to be 20 again. But can you turn back the clock and be 20 again once you're 70? No. So what happens is we go through life chasing blanks. If I only had blank, then everything would be complete. And you achieve some of those dreams. And when you achieve a dream, then it's on to the next one, and then the next one, and then the one after that. And we're always chasing blanks. And Solomon had all his blanks filled. He had anything he wanted. Was he happy? No. Vanity and the striving after wind. No profit under the sun. This is not what provides happiness. Here you've got a guy that, you know, and archaeologists refer to the gates of Giza as the Solomonic gates of Giza. He had architecture named after him. He had monuments. He had parks. He had gardens. He had palaces. He had the temple of the Lord. He had fame. He had splendor. He had wealth. He had wisdom. He had it all, and yet he was miserable with all these things because none of these things in and of themselves do it. With the drive of a type A person, he's trying to beat the cycle, the never-ending cycle. He's going to try to beat the system, but does he beat the system? No, he doesn't, because nothing in and of itself in this life under the sun does it. And people try to chase happiness in all the wrong places, through materialism or a thousand other things we've mentioned here. And it still leaves us bankrupt spiritually. And so here you have vanity and striving after wind. Okay, let's go to chapter 12. In fact, I'd like to start with a segue in the end of chapter 11. And in verse 8 through 10 of chapter 11. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all, but let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your body and put away pain from and put away pain from your body for youth and the dawn of life for vanity. In other words, he's telling young people, go ahead and chase your dreams. Go ahead and dream big and chase those dreams. But remember that even when you do that, God will hold you accountable for everything that you do. And with that background in mind, what he says in chapter 12, and this may be one of those unfortunate chapter divisions that were imposed later on in church history. But chapter 12, verse 1 says, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. In other words, there's going to come a time when you get old and you don't derive the pleasure out of life that you used to. And so the time to remember God is when you're still young, when you have energy, vitality, and your whole life ahead of you. That's when you really need to start thinking about God. Now, I would tell older folks who haven't obeyed the gospel yet, it's never too late as long as there's life and breath. But I tell younger folks, remember God now. Don't wait. Remember God now. The time to remember God is now, whatever station in life you happen to be at. But remember God before you get old, before all this happens. And he describes the aging process in a number of figures of speech. He says in verse 2, before the light, or the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. We lived in Oregon for a couple of years. And one winter, it rained for 33 straight days. And I just hated it. When you don't see the sun day after day, and it's just a continual dripping of rain, it messes with your emotions. And figuratively speaking, there comes a time in life where you have one gloomy day right after another, and the sunshiny days are few and far between. Remember God before that happens, is what he's saying. Before the gloom hits. Verse 3, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble. I believe he's talking about the aging process here, and people get old and they shake. Maybe Parkinson's disease hits or something. And the strong men are bent. Osteoporosis sets in. We've got a woman at church, she's older, and she walks around like this. She can't stand up erect. And the grinders cease because they're few. Your teeth fall out. And those who look through the windows are dimmed. I was just telling my gracious host this morning, I can't make sure I have my glasses because I don't like to wear them, but I'm getting to where I can't preach without them anymore because the eyesight goes and it gets worse. And the doors on the street are shut, verse 4, when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of song are brought low. The grinding mill was the place of hustle and bustle, especially during harvest season. Anybody who was anybody was there in the middle of the festivities involved, except for people who were shoved out or voluntarily dismissed themselves because of retirement, who are not part of the action anymore. And moreover, they're aroused easily at the sound of a bird. Either they wake up early, or even when there's festivity, all the daughters of song are brought low. They don't want to be a part of all that festivity anymore, or they can't hear it or enjoy it, even if they would be a part of it. And it's a sad thing that older folks tend to withdraw more and more and more. Verse 5 says, they are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are on the way. In other words, don't want to get out, don't want to take a vacation, too much work, don't want to drive at night, can't see anyway. It's just... And so a person just kind of stays home at that point in life. The almond tree blossoms. What color do almond trees turn? White. The hair turns gray. The grasshopper drags itself along. Grasshoppers aren't supposed to drag, you know. But you see one of these little kids with all this energy, and they're kind of running around like this. And then you see an older person just kind of dragging, and we get to that point in life, and desire fails. Some of your translations will say the caperberry is ineffective, or desire fails. It's literally sexual desire here, and we live in an age in which you have all these commercials on TV about products that are supposed to, return you to your youth, but there comes a point that which all the products in the world don't cause the parts to work any longer. And I don't want to be crude in the pulpit here, but the point is made that we grow old and the body doesn't function like it used to. Because man is going to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. That's a funeral scene. Before the silver cord is snapped or the golden bowl is broken or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain or the wheel is broken at the cistern. In other words, imagine an ancient Israelite with a gold-plated piece of pottery and someone just knocks it over and it's burst into 1,000 pieces. Can you glue them all back together and pretend you have your nice piece of pottery? Good as new? No. Nor can you turn back the clock when you're 80 years old, be 20 again. Doesn't work that way. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. If this is all there is to life, where we go through the motions, pass the torch to the next generation, grow old, die, and then are forgotten by our great-great-great-great-great-grandkids, then why are we here anyway? And there's nothing but vanity in all the historic pursuits of mankind. Money doesn't do it. Sensual pleasure doesn't do it. Fame doesn't do it. Power doesn't do it. Why are we here anyway, if that's all there is to life? The only thing left, and we haven't dealt with it all because we haven't read the whole book of Ecclesiastes, but the only thing left is the obvious. At the end of the book, verses 13 and 14, and I haven't gone through these slides, but childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. You're going to get old fast. And you have the compelling conclusion, verses 13 and 14. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, for God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. You know, I had done this lesson probably already hundreds of times before this next thought really hit me. We had an elder in Southern California where I was in Tustin who used to say that when I wasn't looking, the Holy Spirit slipped one in on me. And he was joking there. But nonetheless, you study the Bible and you see new insights the longer you study. And I came to this conclusion. This just hit me one day. And it hit me in the form of a question. Let me have you think about this with me for a minute. Can our lives be invested with purpose and meaning with eternal dimensions in the absence of accountability? Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole purpose of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with everything that is hidden, whether it be good or evil. Carl Sagan, famous scientist, who was an agnostic, wrote a book, The Cosmos, some years ago. First sentence in that book is, the cosmos is all it is or was or ever will be. I prefer the first sentence of another book that says, in the beginning, God. Okay. But anyway, he wrote another book toward the end of his life, Pale Blue Dot. And the book Pale Blue Dot opens up on the thought of the Voyager spacecrafts that were sent out into outer space, especially the Voyager 2, that the farther it got away, it would shoot pictures of Earth and send those pictures back to Earth. The farther it got away, the Earth got smaller and smaller until it was finally nothing but a pale blue dot in a vast expanse of space that was so great that just unfathomable how big this universe is and how small we are in comparison. We're like little ant-like creatures on a pale blue dot in total insignificance in the bigger scheme of things. And this is the point that Mr. Sagan made. He said, we think that what we're doing here on Earth is so important, but it's really not. We're little creatures on a pale blue dot, and there's nothing or no one out there to save us from ourselves. And I want to tell you something. If you take God out of the equation, and you take Judgment Day out of the equation, He is absolutely right. But if you put God back into the equation, and you put Judgment Day back into the equation, put the idea into the equation that we have a day in court awaiting us, and that this life on earth is a probationary period, and we are on trial right now, and everything that we do, everything that we say, everything that we think is fair game. What does that do to your value right now? You take God away and you take Judgment Day away, you're nothing but an ant-like creature on a pale blue dot. But if you put God back into the equation, you put Judgment Day in the equation, what does that do to your value? All of a sudden, everything that you think is important, and it has eternal dimensions. Eternity is hanging in the balance. And what I'm doing now is incredibly important because God is there and Judgment Day is there. It revolutionizes your value and your worth and your purpose in life here. And it really didn't hit me quite that way until I studied Ecclesiastes for oogles of time. But it finally hit me. That's what he's saying here, I think. That we need Judgment Day and we need God to validate our purpose. If we don't have God, we don't have Judgment Day, we're nothing. And there's no getting around that. And when I make that point with non-Christians, it hits them over the head like a ton of lead. Because they never thought that before. And when they think that thought for the very first time, they begin to think, well, what's the, you know, fearing God all about? What are these commandments all about? Tell me more. And at that point, I get an appointment to talk with them about the gospel of Christ. I'm going to encourage you to use this material with others. But first of all, take it to heart yourself. And we get so caught up on so many things. And sometimes we forget about the most important because we're in the middle of a rut. And we forget to see the big picture. And that's the lesson for this morning.